there. Today is Wednesday, December the 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are in the midst of having some audio difficulties, so I am going to talk a little bit about what's happening in the news until we can get our engineers to work on this. We hope you're having a great week, and we will be talking a lot about what is happening in Washington, D.C., including promises of non-cooperation ahead of President Trump's imminent impeachment trial, as Republicans vow not to cooperate and provide witnesses to Democrats. The British are weighing in on how they're feeling now that Brexit is all but inevitable. And we've got women full speed ahead, stories of women succeeding in music, in sports, and in activism. But of course, we begin with the impending impeachment of President Donald Trump. He has angrily objected to impeachment in the House of Representatives, articles of impeachment, accusing Democrats of, quote, perversion of justice and abuse of power in their efforts to remove him from office. In a fiery letter Tuesday to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the eve of his expected impeachment, Trump maintained that he did nothing wrong in seeking foreign investigations of his political rivals, and he went on to attack Democrats for focusing on impeachment rather than other issues. The president has been repeating his objections to the process of the House inquiry, claiming more due process was afforded to those, quote, accused in the Salem witch trials. Those claims have been fact-checked and proven false. Salem witch trials involved women being burned at the stake. President Trump says he doesn't believe his letter will change anything, but he is registering his objections for the purpose of history. Now, the Democratic Majority House Rules Committee met through the day on Tuesday with lawmakers arguing over the parameters for Wednesday's debate, which is expected to culminate in votes to make Trump the third president to be impeached in American history. Now, the top committee Republican, Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, said that the split view in the public among Americans over impeachment should be reason enough not to proceed with the rare action. House Democrats are planning later today to launch the debate and likely votes to formally impeach President Trump, accusing him of abusing his power as president and dealing with Ukraine. And now we are going to hear from congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson with a look ahead to the historic vote that will trigger a trial of Trump in the U.S. Senate early next year.
To me, I'd let the Senate.
A defiant Donald Trump says he takes no responsibility for impeachment.
No, I don't take any, zero, to put it mildly.
As Democrats prepared articles of impeachment for a full vote in the U.S. House of Representatives.
No one should be allowed to use the powers of the presidency to undermine our elections or cheat in a campaign, no matter who it is, and no matter what their party. We all took an oath not to defend a political party, but to uphold the Constitution of the United States. History is testing us.
But Republicans say history will view the move differently.
There's no way this can or should be viewed as legitimate. Certainly not by Republicans whose minority rights have been trampled on every step on the way. And certainly not by the American people observing this disastrous political show scene by scene.
The vote will make Trump the third impeached president in U.S. history. Democrat Zoe Lofgren, involved in all three modern impeachments, says Trump's actions are the most serious.
It's never happened before in the history of our country that a president would just simply say, I don't like what you're doing, and you get no information from me. That's astonishing.
Several House Democrats who represent Trump-supporting areas agree, risking their political fates in next year's election to vote for impeachment.
This is not something that you can do based on polls and based on what a political consultant tells you to do. And I feel firmly in that. And the voters will have a chance to decide next year. And, you know, the biggest honor of my life to represent this district, but I'm not going to compromise my integrity to do it.
This is the articles that we wrote.
The impeachment battle in the U.S. House has deepened party divides, and the coming trial is already dividing Senate leaders. The head of the Republican majority Senate has said he will work closely with the White House.
The Senate is meant to act as judge and jury, to hear a trial, not to rerun the entire fact-finding investigation because angry partisans rushed sloppily through it.
But the Senate impeachment is meant to hold a president accountable, said his Democratic counterpart.
Mitch McConnell said proudly, he is not an impartial juror. Do the American people want Mitch McConnell not to be an impartial juror in this situation? And I would ask every one of my Republican Senate colleagues, are you impartial jurors?
The three-month impeachment process about to end in the U.S. House and is just getting started in the U.S. Senate. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Well, the issue of trade has been something President Trump has spoken about since before he came into office, and an issue he has vowed to take on. There have been some developments recently regarding U.S. trade deals. Joining us to talk about it is Joel Paul, a professor at UC Hastings Law School. What can you tell us about this preliminary deal between the U.S. and China?
It's actually more of a truce in the trade war. The tariffs that are in place will remain in place, but future tariffs that Trump had intended to impose last week will not be imposed for the time being. And China has promised that over the next couple of years, they're going to buy some $200 billion worth of additional U.S. export, although it's not entirely clear how they're going to do that or what exports they're going to buy.
And then we've got Congress basically agreeing to something, which is great in and of itself, the USMCA, which is basically a revised NAFTA. Is that my understanding that this is going to go through?
Yes, the USMCA is basically a warmed-over, somewhat improved NAFTA agreement. It has a lot of wonky provisions in it, like opening up the Canadian milk market to U.S. dairy exports and slightly increasing the amount of North American content in automobiles from 62.5% to 75%, stuff like that. Probably the most significant thing which the Democrats insisted upon is that it is including some guarantees that the Mexicans have promised to make it easier for workers to unionize. And there's some ambiguity about the possibility of U.S. monitors being present in Mexico to help facilitate the enforcement of that agreement. But it's a bit vague at the moment.
Okay, and I know there's another trade story out there that you have been talking a lot about, but we really haven't heard much about at all. But you've been noting that it's actually a pretty big deal having to do with the U.S. and the World Trade Organization.
I think this is really the big story that most people are missing. The Trump administration over the last couple of years has been refusing to allow the appointment of any judges on the World Trade Organization's appellate body. The appellate body is the dispute settlement body in the World Trade Organization, and hundreds of disputes have been brought to this body and have been settled peacefully by the World Trade Organization. There's a very high degree of compliance with their decisions. The Trump administration, by refusing to appoint any judges, has effectively paralyzed the organization because the judges each have a six-year term, and all of the existing judges, the people who are on the World Trade Organization appellate body, their terms have now lapsed. So there's no one left. They have no judges. And so the World Trade Organization can no longer be available to us as a tool to resolve trade disputes. This really is shooting ourselves in the foot because we have relied time and time again in settling disputes with the Europeans and other countries on the World Trade Organization, and that's no longer available to us. What you're left with then is essentially the law of the jungle. It's every country for itself, everyone imposing reciprocal or retaliatory trade tariffs, and it's going to be complete chaos, which is not good for the world economy, and it's not good for international investment.
Do you expect any movement on this, and why is no one talking about this?
Well, the Trump administration has this attitude, which we've seen time and again in various international organizations, that they want to go it alone, that they don't believe in international or multilateral organizations and institutions. They don't seem to have a strong commitment to international law or to alliances, and they seem determined that they're going to somehow force other countries to go along with what we want by threatening them with trade sanctions. And of course, the irony is that these tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed are being paid by U.S. consumers and U.S. businesses. And the trade deficit, which Mr. Trump has constantly pointed to as a symptom of what's wrong with America, the trade deficit has gone up by 27% in Mr. Trump's years in office. So we are really hurting ourselves, and I don't see any change in the near future.
All right, that's Joel Paul. He's a professor at the UC Hastings Law School. We thank you so much for being with us. Well, some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com include the U.S. Congress approving a Russian-Europe gas pipeline sanctions. The House passes $1.4 trillion federal spending bill. The U.S. has deported a convicted German killer. And Human Rights Watch says Israel should allow Palestinians freedom of expression. You can find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. In the meantime, UK lawmakers from all parties were sworn in Tuesday, the first day of the new session in Parliament. Britain's new political landscape began to take shape Monday as triumphant Prime Minister Boris Johnson talked trade with President Donald Trump and gave a pep talk to his new Conservative Party lawmakers. After his decisive win, Johnson plans to move fast on his campaign mantra to ensure a Brexit withdrawal agreement bill is passed in time for the UK to complete its historic departure from the European Union by the January 31st deadline.
We've had 3.5 years of wrangling, particularly about Brexit. It's time for us as a country to move on. And it's time for us to come together and deliver on our One Nation agenda. That's what I want to do.
Johnson's Conservatives received a larger-than-expected majority in last week's national election, galvanizing his efforts to secure parliamentary approval for his Brexit divorce deal with the European Union. Joining us from London is reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, what is the mood there now that this is very clear that people have spoken?
Among everyone, remainers included, there seems to be a collective sigh of relief that the results of the vote that took place originally on Brexit will be honored, and more importantly, that the logjam surrounding this, the political dueling that has gone on for years now, is no more, and that there will be no more effort to use Parliament as a weapon to block Brexit or drive other political agendas. The private sector, businesses are relieved that there's more certainty that decisions will be taken in a structured way rather than in a chaotic way. And the government has a majority, so it can proceed without obstacles.
Will it happen on deadline, with or without a deal?
There's likely to be a deal. At this point, most things have been decided except for the details of the trade aspect. So they're literally only hammering out now, at this stage, the trade agreement. And the trade agreement will be simpler than most people imagine. And it's very likely the EU will do a deal. Boris drove them to the line last time, and they backed off of the contentious issues, and we're expecting them to do so again. There will be the usual suspects politically who shout and scream, but in the end, it's basically a trade deal that's being negotiated. And the difference here, too, is that the big issues that would become obstacles for other countries negotiating trade deals with the EU don't exist for the UK because we've been a part of the EU for so long. So it's things like compliance. The UK is already completely and fully compliant with the EU's rules and regulations because we have had to be as a function of our membership in the EU. So this trade deal should actually be a lot simpler than many think. There will be room to diverge for certain sectors, probably the financial and bioscience sectors, among others, because these are sectors that are more important to the UK's financial health than the EU's. So they will want certain special provisions covering those sectors. But those are not likely the obstacles that will hold things up.
Are there any lingering concerns, though, regarding borders or anything at all?
There are concerns and there will be concerns, but most especially about tariffs, and it's doubtful that any of these will be insurmountable. So, of course, the Germans aren't going to want high tariffs on their cars, but the Brits won't want high tariffs on their exports either. So there should be some reciprocity here.
How will life change overall in the UK after so many years of being a part of the EU?
Well, nothing's going to change until the end of the transition period, which is December 31st, 2020. And then a lot less will change than people imagine. There will most likely be free travel with something like an EU visa. This is what they're talking about, so that you would essentially apply for a visa covering all members of the EU that would last for a number of years. And again, Brits could travel fairly freely and vice versa. Brits living abroad are covered under the agreement, so their lives should remain fairly unchanged. Equally, Europeans living in the UK are covered under the agreement. So really, the only things that will change are the way we go about certain processes. But I think people will adapt to those pretty quickly.
All right. London-based reporter Amy Gutman, thank you so much. Well, a three-day summit tackling the world's refugee crisis is underway in Geneva, Switzerland. Thousands of delegates, including around 100 government ministers, are attending the UN Global Refugee Forum to discuss how to help the tens of millions of people who have been forced to flee their homes, many through intense conflict. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Europe's refugee crisis is no longer in the headlines, but thousands of migrants continue to arrive on its shores seeking a better life. For many, this is the brutal reality. On the edge of the EU, squalid makeshift camps like this one in Bosnia are growing in number. The broken dreams of a new life in the West as Europe strengthens its borders.
People, all people, not animal. Okay. You see, you world see. All people, very cool weather, no sleeping, no food, big problem.
The United Nations estimates that globally 70.8 million people have been forcibly displaced from their homes, an unprecedented number of refugees. The UN says most countries, especially richer nations, are not doing enough to help. The Global Refugee Forum in Geneva is aimed at tackling the disparity.
The central idea is to share the burden and the responsibilities of this vast and unprecedented number of people, this movement of people globally.
There have been similar calls in the past. Tragedies like the drowning of three-year-old Syrian refugee Alan Kurdi in 2015 have triggered global demands for action with little result. Turkey hosts over 3.5 million refugees, most escaping the war in Syria. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is among the delegates in Geneva. Turkey has repeatedly criticized Europe's migrant policies. Under a 2016 agreement, Ankara began to stop migrants crossing into Greece in return for $6.7 billion in aid. Tens of thousands of migrants remain stuck in camps on the Greek islands. The refugee crisis stretches far beyond Europe. 750,000 Rohingya refugees live in camps in Bangladesh, having escaped a military offensive in Myanmar. Sub-Saharan Africa hosts more than a quarter of the world's refugee population. Conflicts in the Central African Republic, Nigeria, South Sudan, Burundi, and Yemen have contributed to the crisis, with 18 million people forced from their homes. And in Venezuela, the political crisis has morphed into a humanitarian catastrophe, with 4 million people fleeing the country. The UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, says it has a funding shortfall of $3.5 billion, or 43% of its budget. It hopes the Geneva summit will prove a watershed.
We have very optimistic indications at the moment that we'll get significant financial commitments, both by governments and through the banking lending facilities. But we'll also get engagement with civil society and the business community.
That appears optimistic, given the scale of the crisis and the myriad causes that are driving so many people from their homes. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues now with three stories about women making strides in the world, in sports, music, and activism. And we begin in conservative Pakistan, where women's sports still lag far behind their male counterparts. But that has not stopped women who enjoy sports from pushing the boundaries and demanding change. In a poor neighborhood in Pakistan's largest city of Karachi, young women are so passionate about football that they have persisted despite the disapproval of their own families and society. But as Ayesha Tanzim reports from Karachi, the young women still have doubts about a future in the sport.
Watching them practice on a sunny afternoon, it is hard to imagine the challenges these young girls had to overcome to be here.
I belong to Liari in Karachi. In our area, girls are not allowed to play football. I had to face an uphill battle. My family told me girls don't play football. I worked hard to convince my family. Now, after watching me become the team captain, they are beginning to slowly change their minds.
These young women belong to a local football club called Jaffa Academy in Karachi's low-income neighborhood, Liari. It is one of many similar private football clubs for girls across the country. While it is registered with the National Football Federation, it receives no funding. The coaches are volunteers. The gear is donated by wealthy individuals. In addition to all the social opposition, many of these girls face tough financial conditions at home. Some are forced to give in to the circumstances despite their passion and talent.
One of our excellent players used to play midfield and was the vice captain of the team is not with us anymore because her family doesn't support her playing football. Her mother is blind and her brothers discourage her and want her to stay home instead. Another one of our excellent players who used to play forward now has to work for a living after her father died.
Those who manage to swim against the tide and follow their passion complain that they get little official support. While Pakistan has a national women's team, it suffers from lack of resources and general apathy. These young girls say while they've convinced their families to allow them to play, they find it harder to believe they have a future in the sport. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Karachi.
Well, Swedish climate activist, the young woman Greta Thunberg, has shot to fame for her unrelenting message to world leaders to do something to combat global warming. She was recently named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, and now we are learning that a documentary of her story will be released soon. Here's a sampling of what we can expect.
We are on a school strike for the climate. Every Friday, we will sit outside the Swedish Parliament until Sweden is in line with the Paris Agreement. We urge everyone to do the same, wherever you are. Sit outside your parliament or local government building until your nation is on a safe pathway to a below 2-degree warming target. If we include all of Sweden's current emissions, including aviation, shipping and imported goods, and if we take into account the aspect of equity to poorer countries, clearly stated in the Paris Agreement and the Kyoto Protocol, rich countries like Sweden need to start reducing emissions by at least 15% every year, according to Uppsala University. By doing so, we enable a chance for developing countries to heighten their standard of living by building some of the infrastructure that we have already built, such as roads, schools, hospitals, clean drinking water, electricity, etc. Sweden is often referred to as a role model, but if we include all of our emissions, we actually have among the top 10 highest ecological footprints per capita. If everyone lived as we do, we would need 4.2 planet Earth per year. That means that countries like Sweden steal 3.2 years of natural resources from future generations and poorer parts of the world every year. We who belong to those future generations demand Sweden and all other countries to put an end to that and start living within the planetary boundaries. Some people say that we should be in school instead. But why should we be studying for a future that soon will be no more? And when no one is doing anything whatsoever to save that future? And what is the point of learning facts within the school system when the most important facts given by the finest science of that same school system clearly means nothing to our politicians and our society?
Well, Thunberg took part in demonstrations and other activities at last week's climate summit in Madrid and says her Fridays for Future school strikes will continue. '19 has been a very good year for singer Billie Eilish. She's nominated for 4 categories in the upcoming Grammy Awards. And the youngest person ever nominated for a Grammy. She's won a slew of other big awards, including most recently named Woman of the Year at the Billboard Music Awards, where she praised all the women who paved the way for her to have this moment.
I want to thank all the women in the past who have been the reason that I can be the way that I am and do what I want, and like paved the way for me and an entire generation of young women who, you know, women who in the past have like done what they weren't supposed to do has made my life a lot easier and made me able to do what I want and be what I want. So thank you to those women.
Well, today is also her 18th birthday. She says she's excited about it, but terrified that potential critics will feel emboldened to publicly attack her now that she is officially an adult. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
So you're a tough guy, like you really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad.